My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Brant, and I'm joined today by Lindsay Park. Lindsay, how are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks.
Lindsay has got to be the most patient person that I've ever met. We've gone through and recorded this interview once, and then I looked on my computer to start editing it and realized I didn't hit the record button. So this is the second time around, and I think that Lindsay's perfected all of her stories and everything. So you guys will get the awesome, amazing edition.
I do. I take it as a sign from the spirit that that first one was not meant to be.
You know, bringing religion into it this quickly, that's what I like to hear.
Testify, yeah. Brent.
Exactly. So let's talk about your early life. You were originally born and raised in Murray, Utah. Is that right?
Yep.
Where exactly is – I don't even know where Murray is.
Murray is just south of Salt Lake. It's kind of tucked in between Salt Lake and Sandy, Utah.
Okay.
It's God's country.
It's God's country. Is it a farming area? Is it more of a city, suburban type area?
It's more suburban now. It's a nice area. It's a great place to grow up. I really enjoyed it.
So tell me about growing up in Murray.
Well, I grew up in a really tight-knit ward that had a lot of kids in it. I think there was like 26 boys and 4 girls my age. And we would all run around together in the neighborhood, in this safe little neighborhood. We were from house to house and play night games and truth or dare. I think I kissed every single boy in that neighborhood at least once.
My.
Yeah, you know I get around.
So let's talk about your childhood a little bit. Anything stand out to you as something that you'd say is kind of life-defining, or was it just a normal childhood going through the primary program?
You know, I was it was just a great childhood. The church was hugely influential in my life, and my family was there, and the neighbor kids were really influential, and I really don't have any complaints. I remember kind of in fifth grade becoming an activist. I started an environmentalist club.
Really?
And yeah, to save water, conserve water or something. I think that we had done that as a debate topic. And I started a club and I got signups and I planned a meeting on a Saturday. And my dad followed me in the car. I had like poster boards as I walked to the playground. I was going to meet with all the kids there and nobody showed up. And my family loves to laugh about that. But I started early just wanting to get involved and do some good.
Do you think that planted the bug for later on in your life?
Oh, for sure. My family, sometimes they ask why I'm the way that I am now. And I'm like, don't you remember all the stuff I used to do? I mean, I was always coming up with these really ridiculous schemes as a kid, but it's definitely carried over.
Mm-hmm. So a pretty normal childhood. What about your youth experience? I got to imagine that with an area like that where there's a lot of kids, it sounds like you had a pretty good youth group growing up too.
Yeah, I mean, I stayed in the same house my whole entire life, and most of the kids in my neighborhood did too. So we just kind of all grew up together and moved through school together. And even though we weren't all in the same groups at school, we were really close as a ward. So my youth experiences were really great, and I was always part of the group, part of the crowd. I never felt like I was on the fringes. Because I had that court group in my ward, and that really helped me out, I think.
Let me ask you another question, just a culture question that I don't really understand being out here in Michigan, but it seems like there's a lot of people that put a lot of emphasis if you're the seminary president or on the seminary council. Are those things really big deals along the lines of being a class president or something like that?
Yeah, for us it was, and that was the group that I ran in. And so for us, it mattered. It was a big deal for us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, now looking outside and wondering about some of the other people, if they thought we were nerdy Mormon kids, but it was a big deal to us. In Utah, at least where I grew up, there is a very big culture of attaching status to church leadership and that kind of thing. So it started young.
And that's one of the things that I find so intriguing about a culture like that in Utah. I waffle sometimes if I'd ever want to move out to Utah to be around that, because I find it to be so fascinating, especially me as an outsider, someone who came from convert parents and has lived here in Michigan my entire life. But I don't know if I could ever live there, because I think it would just become a little overbearing. But I've always found that fascinating, is if you hear people talking about their ancestral lines going back, oh, well, I can connect myself to Elder so-and-so, or, yeah, oh, well, I'm part of this line, and this is an influential line.
Yeah, and I had a few friends who were grandsons or granddaughters to general authorities like the Quorum of the Twelve. We had two different Quorum of the Twelve, grandchildren in our group. So there's definitely a status attached to that.
Were they treated any differently?
I'll tell you this, at their missionary farewells, they had more people show up than would probably normally have showed up, you know, otherwise, to kind of spy the general authority. But I don't know, it's hard for me to say, because like I said, I was part of the group. So I never really stopped to think about what it would be like to not be part of the group. I was really lucky. I had my best friend, actually, who was an outsider. She moved into our neighborhood when we were in sixth grade. And she was this tall Hawaiian girl, kind of like Pocahontas. They called her Pocahontas. And I was like this short white girl, and we were all white in our neighborhood. So she was like this completely different character that came into our lives, and she was very intelligent and outspoken. She always had very different interests than I did. I was really part of that Mormon culture, and she was Mormon and active, but she introduced me to Radiohead and the Smashing Pumpkins, and I quickly converted into cool stuff thanks to her. But she, in high school, she ran around with kind of the rougher group. They were the kids that did drugs and dressed in black. And she wasn't part of that. She never did drugs or anything like that, but that's who she identified with. So it was really beneficial for me because, you know, I was this clean-cut Mormon kid, and I got to cross these social lines to hang out with these, you know, rebel kids. And that was a really good experience for me. Her influence is huge on my life. We became such good friends, and today, to this day, where we talk every day on the phone, and she has a huge part in the story of my life. So, and I'm sure we'll talk about her some more, but yeah, she definitely opened my mind up to new experiences I would have never had otherwise.
So going through high school is just, high school's high school, right? Nothing earth shaking happening in high school, really.
I remember when I was in 10th grade, I was a sophomore, I started feeling a little bit different, like chemically. It was almost like, you know, the chemicals in my brain started to change. And I think that was the first time I'd experienced depression. But I was such a happy-go-lucky kid, I didn't know what to make of that. But 10th grade was the first time I just remember feeling different. And 10th grade was kind of the change for me. And I remember one of the, like, big moments of my high school life as I was walking down the hallway, and I noticed this boy, and there was something just striking about him. We became really good friends. Well, throughout our high school career, he was a year older than me. I just like fell head over heels in love with him. But I had that rule of, you know, I wasn't going to single date anyone. And thank goodness I did have that rule, because I think that saved me from a lot of trouble. But, as he graduated and I became a senior, he got his mission call to Australia, and we decided, he didn't officially ask me to wait for him on his mission, but we were kind of in love at that point. There was just this understanding between us that I would write him and that we were in love. Does that make sense?
It was kind of like, well, we both know where this is going to end up, but I have to be nice and tell you to date people. And
right.
You have to be nice and say, yes, of course, I'm going to date other people.
Right. So we didn't hang out a lot in high school. We had an art class together. And so that's the thing. I was this really happy-go-lucky kid involved with all these outgoing social kids. But on the other hand, was working towards a scholarship for art. And so I had this really artsy side of me. And this kid that I'm talking about, he played the guitar and he loved darker music and poetry. And so we really connected on that, you know, intense poetic level. And that was so seductive to me at the time because I didn't have anyone else like that in my life, kind of deep and dark and tortured teenage youth, you know. And so we connected on that level and it was so intense, but it proved to be really dangerous for me later on. But he decided to go on the mission and I decided to wait for him. And we had everybody telling us, don't do that. Don't wait for missionary. That's bad news. And of course, you know, when you're that age, you think, oh, you just don't know us. We're different, you know? So that was going on and he left on his mission. And meanwhile, I had a really good friend in my Mormon group who got cancer. One of my biggest regrets is when the missionary left on the mission, I was devastated. it sounds so ridiculous now and I hope people will bear with me. But at the time it was like crushing. And so I have this friend who is dying of cancer and his health is failing. And all I could think about was, oh, poor me and my poor situation and my poor missionary. And so I was really self-involved. And I think I talked about this with you before, but when I was 17, I went into, I was in a dance class for school, just like for my gym credit or something. And that was the first time I kind of noticed that I was not as tone and trim as the other girls. And I wouldn't say that I was overweight, but comparing myself to these other girls, I definitely felt like I was. So I started becoming really conscious of myself and I send this missionary out and everyone's always telling you, well, you know, it never works out. And there's really cute girls where he's going and, you know, you'll come back and be two different people. And I was determined to beat all of those odds. So I was really concerned about keeping myself up and looking good. He never seemed to be into me physically as much as he was emotionally. And that bothered me. You know, our relationship was built on something different, but I wanted him to think that I was pretty. And so I really internalized that and thought, well, it's because I'm not pretty. And so I started skipping meals my senior year and losing weight. And as I lost weight, people would compliment me on it, like, wow, you're really looking good. And so it totally reinforced that there was something wrong with me because now all of a sudden I was getting this positive reinforcement. And I remember it got to the point where I would love the feeling of hunger pains because that was like that I was like being successful. So I started losing weight and my mom started to notice. And of course, she interpreted it as vanity. She thought, you know, her daughter was being vain. And so she kind of responded in a way that probably wasn't helpful. But in her defense, we knew nothing about these issues at the time. So for her, it was just, you know, her child is being naughty. Let's correct the behavior. So she started, you know, saying, you're going to eat. And if you don't eat, you're going to be in trouble. And she went as far as to say, if you skip meals at school, I'm going to come sit with you and all your friends and force the food down your throat. I believed her. And she probably would have done it too. So that terrified me. So I started eating out of fear. So meanwhile, I had developed all these really unhealthy thinking patterns about my physical appearance and about my food, but I was feeling pressure and fear to eat. And so I developed a really bad eating disorder. And if you know anything about eating disorders, they're a lot about control. If someone doesn't have a lot of control in their outside life, the one thing they try to control is their food, because that's an easy thing to control. So it was really hard for me because I felt like my mom was trying to take control away from my food. The only thing I could control. Because, you know, I had this friend who was dying and this missionary out there and all this other stuff that high school kids go through. That was the one thing I could control. And so I, you know, I graduated high school and I started binging on food. I would eat like 8 bowls of cereal at a time. Then I would feel awful about it. So I started exercising compulsively all summer long. And I got accepted on a scholarship, an art scholarship to Utah State in Logan. It's so hard because this time in my life, there were so many great things going on, but so many dark things. And the only way I can describe it is I felt like I had a divided heart. Does that make sense? I was two people.
Like a public and a private person almost.
Yeah. And I was genuinely both of those people. There was happy Lindsay, and then there was really, really unhappy, troubled Lindsay. So we went up to college and it was a lot of fun, lots of social stuff going on. And I loved the independence, being away from my parents. That really helped. The marriage culture up there, at least when I was there, was really strong. Our ward directory, we called the menu. And they would take our picture and put it next to our name. And I remember this is so awful, but walking out of Relief Society, all the men would be lined up in the hall, like with their arms folded, just kind of like it was a meat market. We'd walk by and they would, you know, nod approval or.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And at the time it just seemed the pressure was, it was so bad. I remember feeling kind of validated, like, wow, there's so many people that want to ask me out. But at the same time, that was a lot of pressure. And we just had return missionaries on our heels all the time. I think one of my roommates, she was proposed to twice. I had like 4 companionship inventories with our dates. That's what we called it.
You call it companionship inventories where you're kind of.
Yeah, because they would go on like 3 dates with you. They were fresh off the mission. So they'd go on 3 dates with you and then they'd want to have the talk of like, well, where are we at? Where are we going with this?
So, you guys never called it a DTR?
No, but that would have been appropriate, actually.
Oh, yeah. That was commonplace at BYU-Idaho. 3 dates, and then you have a DTR to determine the relationship.
That's exactly that's exactly the script that it followed. So, you know, it was fun and it was flattering, and I was into it. But my best friend, Malia, this Hawaiian girl I told you about, she was not having it. She didn't like these kind of people. She didn't like the culture. She would get asked out and she would tell people no. She just was not having it.
Let me ask you this, and I'm sure this is probably completely insensitive of me, but was she having the same success as you were?
Like as far as getting dates, you mean?
Yeah.
No, and she wasn't, and she's a beautiful, beautiful girl. But I should say I'm friendly and outgoing. And she would purposely be cold to people she didn't like. And she's tall and she's a minority in Utah. And so I think that I think men were intimidated by her, you know, and people would call her the Lamanite and yeah, things like that. And at the time it didn't, you know, it didn't register to me because I grew up with her. We would make she was my minority sidekick. That's what, you know, we called her. And I didn't realize how insensitive these things were because that's just how we grew up. But she, you know, she remembers wishing that she had blonde hair as a little girl and that kind of stuff. But she was definitely starting to distance herself from this Mormon dating culture. And I was totally into it. It was really safe for me because I would go on these dates and say, oh, but I've got this missionary. And I had no interest in marriage. But meanwhile, my friend who had cancer, he passed away, and he passed away as an atheist. He had lost his belief in God, and I was really troubled by that, and I was really insensitive, and I didn't understand, and I tried to preach to him, and here's Lindsay trying to say, 17-year-old Lindsay trying to say, oh, you know, you need to be more patient with God, and maybe he's trying to teach you something. And here's this kid losing his entire, you know, rest of his life saying, you know, if God does exist, he's mean and vengeful, and we're just little pawns in his game. And I remember thinking, oh, you're so naive and you're so selfish. And really it was me that was that way. And that was one of my big regrets. Is how how self-involved and naive I was to the plight that he was facing. For me, it was so simple. And for him, it was so complicated and dark. And he, I don't want to devalue his life or anything, but he died, I think, angry, very angry at his situation. And I don't think that there's any shame in that. At the time, I thought that there was, you know, that we should all be, oh, happy. You know, this is God's challenge for you. I don't know. I can't remember the exact things I said, but I do know that I was an idiot.
but in a sense, it goes back to that dichotomy that you were experiencing of on the outside. It was everything's okay. And oh, you're having a problem with cancer, but it's okay. But on the inside, you're really torn at this point.
Yeah, and that was my entire life. I was very faithful and very involved in the church. And that script that you hear in church of, if you do A and B, then C will happen. If you live this way and this way, then if you're righteous, then you'll be blessed. I believe that 100%. Because I had lived a pretty good, blessed life. And any of the bad things that were happening, I took as my own sense of wickedness, you know. So this eating disorder that was starting to really get out of control, I took as Lindsay is being wicked because she's being vain and selfish, and she's worried about what she looks like. And so for me, it was the script is working because I'm not following, you know, if I could just get over this vanity, then I could get over this problem. The Book of Mormon is right. If I could just get over my pride, then I would succeed. And so college was going really great, and I was doing really well in the art program. I was just excelling. And but my eating disorder started to get out of hand. And at Christmas time that first semester, my best friend Malia had met a man that was older than her, and they were going to meet at a Smashing Pumpkins concert in Chicago. And this was really scandalous for me because she was going alone with this man. And, you know, here's someone who didn't single date until she was 18. This just seemed naughty to me. And she wasn't going to tell her mom because her mom didn't approve. And so she secretly organized this trip to go meet him at this concert in Chicago. And right before she left, we had a talk, and I was telling her, this isn't right. This isn't appropriate. And she said, you know what, I don't believe in the church, Lindsay, and I haven't for a long time. And that just swept the rug out from under me. I didn't even know what to do with that. And I thought, I was saying, you're lying. I've been through Mutual and Young Women's and Girls Camp with you my entire life. I know that you believe the things that I do. And she said, no, Lindsay, I've never felt the Spirit. I've never had an answer to my prayer. And I took it really personally. I felt like she was betraying and denying me, not the church, because for me, they were so intertwined. So she left on her concert, and I was so angry at her and judgmental. I decided it was my job to stand up for what was right and fix this problem and save her. So I called her mom and told her mom that she had gone. And then I, organize all the roommates to give her an ultimatum, basically, which was, you repent for what you're doing or we kick you out.
You'll be voted off the island.
Exactly. So she came back from this concert, and her mom met her at the airport furious and angry. And it was a horrible, ugly scene. And her mom, you know, I wouldn't say that her mom rejected her outright, but it was close. She was in a lot of trouble. And then she came up to us, and we sat her down and said, you need to move out because we can't accept your behavior. You know, because we had found out she had stayed. I can't remember if she stayed in the same hotel room with this guy, but it didn't matter. For us, it was bad enough. Or for me, I should say. I was the one orchestrating the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So we booted her out. She had nothing. She didn't have her family. She didn't have us. All she had was this man that she had met. It was awful, but at the time I felt completely justified. And looking back, I see I was internalizing a lot of my own pain for her. But after she left, so the missionary left, my friend died of cancer, and my friend left. And I remember thinking, all these people have left me, and they left me with their pain and their darkness. And then they left. And I'm here to pick up the pieces. And that's a very self-involved like attitude. But the missionary, he was totally struggling with his mission. And my friend who died of cancer had left in complete pain, and my friend had left. And so I felt like I'm the one that's supposed to carry all of this, and it's not fair. And
well, let me do just a couple of follow-ups. So it was almost like these people were leaving your life. They weren't leaving it in a nice, peaceful way. They were leaving it in very much a state of chaos.
Right.
And right. And it was almost like you didn't have control over that. Am I understanding correctly?
Yeah, I had no control over it. I felt so empty inside. And I remember telling one of my therapists once, I wanted to make my outsides as empty as my insides. Mm. Like I could have never eaten again and wasted away. I felt so empty. And in the meantime, life is still going on. College is still going on. People want me to do all of these things. I got called as a stake missionary in my ward. And I felt like that was a really cool calling because, you know, here I have this missionary out in the field and I'm going to get the missionary experience. So I'll catch up with him spiritually. And I threw myself into that, hoping that that would fill me up. And in the meantime, my eating disorder just became out of control, and I started purging, and I was exercising a ton, and it got to the point where I couldn't function. I started skipping class, art class, my second semester, and eating. And we were poor. It's not like we had a lot of money. So I did some really disgusting things because it's like an addiction. It really is. One time, we didn't have any food in the house, so I binged on frozen peas because I just had
I'm sorry for laughing.
No. We can laugh about, trust me, we can laugh about this. Well, and, one time I didn't have very much money, so all I bought was a gallon of ice cream, like one of those big tubs. I know people aren't going to believe this because it's not really physically possible, but I ate almost the entire thing in one sitting, the entire gallon.
Well, and it's so interesting because when you think about someone who's binging, right, I think of going to a place like the Chuck-O-Rama and like like just pounding steak and prime rib and mashed potatoes, like – good stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's not so much the food. It's any food that you can eat. It is kind of what you're telling me.
Well, and we didn't have a lot of money. It's kind of amazing how much food you can put into your body when you're eating emotionally like that. So I was doing that and throwing up to the point where I was exhausted. And so my grades started totally declining. And I decided, oh my gosh, you know, my body's a temple. I'm being wicked. I've got to do something about this. So I decided to go and confess to the bishop about this eating disorder. And I'm really lucky that I had a good bishop because, you know, you never know who you're going to get and what their attitudes are with things that they don't understand. But my bishop was really cool. He was like, you're not sinning, but I want you to come see me again. Just think happy thoughts and that kind of thing. So I started going and seeing him twice a month or something. But I felt shame in that too because, you know, here I am in the stake mission position and I'm gaining status in this ward. A lot of people in the ward saw me as like this outgoing, great potential future wife. And here I am leaving the bishop's office, you know, and when you're in college, what do most kids think that refers to? It's usually some kind of sexual sin, or at least that's what we thought, you know?
Yep. It's a walk of shame almost when you see the line out the bishop's office and then you have to see the person who comes out and everyone stares at them and says,
and that was me. I mean, and I felt that exact same shame leaving. So the bishop was trying to make me feel better, but he didn't have any training. One of the good things he did was refer me to the counseling services on campus. Now in my family, at the time, none of us had ever dealt with mental illness, so there was a huge taboo and a stigma attached to counseling. And even with me, I just felt like people that got counseling were messed up. That wasn't me, even though I knew that it was. You know, I didn't want to be that person, but I decided to privately like take some of my food money and see a counselor, which was free, but then get on some kind of medication. I can't remember. I think that they prescribed me Prozac, and since I didn't tell my parents, it was like $60 a month, which was a lot for me then. But, you know, I didn't have any guidance. And so the Prozac didn't, like, it just numbed me. But it didn't stop the problem. So I finally told my parents about it, and they were furious. I told them that I had gone to a counselor. And because I went to a counselor, that was the only reason why they didn't make me come home from school. But my grades were suffering. I had to tell them. And they didn't understand. And my mom's reaction to it was not a good one. It was, Lindsay's being naughty and she needs to stop. Mm-hmm. And at this point I couldn't stop. I think I told you this. I used to make rules for myself because I felt so guilty. On Sundays, I decided since Sundays was the Lord's day, I would try not to binge or purge that day. And it was so hard for me. So I would like pack a little healthy lunch that felt safe to me, and I would take it off of campus and avoid food the entire day, fill up my day with missionary work or service and writing my scriptures and journal somewhere on campus, and just so I could be out of the house away from that temptation. When I came home that night, like after all the roommates would be asleep, I would end up almost against my will binging and purging until I passed out, you know, while they were all asleep, because I had fought it and thought about it all day. It was like the more that I tried to not think about it, the more I was thinking about it.
So in a sense, it really was like a virus almost taking control of you. I think so many people, when it comes to eating disorders, have the mentality of, for example, if someone has anorexia, well, you just eat. Just eat and things will be better. Or if you have bulimia, just eat a little bit and it'll be okay. But it was almost like you recognized those things were going on and you were trying to take preventative measures. But it was almost like you didn't – it was almost like your body took control and you didn't have control over what your body was doing.
Yeah. And, you know, I had several priesthood blessings at the time, and I thought, you know, if I am just more righteous and I prayed and prayed and prayed and served and served and served and went to the temple, and that wasn't working. So then I tried to avoid it physically, and that only made it worse. And the more that I tried, the worse it got. And it got to the point where, when I had finally come home, got to the point where I knew that either I had to kill myself because it wasn't going to stop, or have an eating disorder the rest of my life. Those were the only two options I could see, because I had fought it in every way possible. And like, I was so diligent and determined to fight this problem. And it would only get worse. And I started losing more weight, and I ended up, I didn't flunk out of my classes, but I lost my scholarship. And I came home and was going to come back up the next semester, but I couldn't function. So I started, you know, trying to get a job to make money so I could go to college on my own. And I couldn't hold a job. My life was in chaos.
And you weren't talking to any professionals at this time?
I was.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Student counseling services are great. They didn't work for me for a variety of reasons. It did do something good for me. It made me realize that I needed a counselor. It kind of broke through that stigma. I already felt like I was the damaged human being. So why not? Let's get a counselor. And that was the godsend for me, is after several really bad therapists, I found a fantastic one. And he was like an angel sent from heaven. The very first session we had, I'm going in and I'm telling him all that, you know, I can't stop. I'm such a horrible person. Can you believe how bad I am and how bad this is? And he offered no judgment. And I kept prompting him, like, come on, tell me this is out of control. Tell me this is bad. And he wouldn't do it. And he said to me, Lindsay, I'm not going to try to take this away from you. Your body needs this. There's a reason why you're doing this. And I was like, wait, what? And he said, listen, the body has these functions and these mechanisms to cope with things, and your body is needing to cope. So I'm interested in figuring out why we're coping, but I'm not interested in taking your coping mechanism away. Your body needs that. And that was huge for me. I was like, wait a minute, you're not going to try to stop me from doing that? It was just like this huge breakthrough, because finally he was letting me have it. And I didn't want it, but I knew that I couldn't give it up. And so it was such a comfort, like, oh my gosh, this is mine. If I want this, this is mine. I get to keep it.
That must have been like just a breath of fresh air to hear that from him.
It was life-changing.
Now, out of curiosity, was he – and this doesn't mean anything for anybody, but was he LDS or not?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't at all. And he did ask me one time. He said, you know, you're going through all these other issues in your life. Why is it the church that you haven't questioned? And, you know, he was talking about how more he has a lot of Mormon clients, and Mormonism has a particularly high number of women with eating disorders, because it's not about the physical appearance so much as the pressure to be of perfection. So I never, you know, blamed the church and brought that into it. I was faithful. And he found that very curious, I think, that that wasn't something that came up in our sessions. So we started doing all that work, and that was great. But I was living at home where my mom and I clashed a lot for control. I still had younger siblings, so she was used to parenting younger kids and having control. And I needed some kind of space, but I didn't have any. So even though I was seeing a counselor, my eating disorder got 10 times worse. And I think I got down to 99 pounds, and I was being monitored by her. She was watching everything I was doing with the food because she was concerned. I don't want to for a minute like vilify her, because she just, my mom and my dad did not understand this at all. So they were just doing it out of concern. But the more that they cracked down, the deeper that it drove me to do dangerous things. And I told you one of the worst, the lowest points of my life was, I started throwing up in garbage bags because she was monitoring the bathroom, you know, and hiding the garbage bags in my room. And I'm sorry, this is probably disgusting for your listeners, but this stuff happens. So I was throwing up in garbage bags and hiding them, and she found it. She found one of my garbage bags, and she showed my little sister. I don't know if it was like a warning, you know, of what could happen or out of concern, but I was mortified because I had already felt so low that I disappointed everybody. But now I disappointed my sisters.
And this was your younger sister, correct?
Like, yeah, I only have two younger sisters. And I felt just like such a screw up, such a mess up. And my whole life I had been, you know, functional and really good at stuff and special, you know, felt special and excelled. And here I was failing completely. It was awful. And it made me suicidal, and it made me depressed. And so my dad decided he would pay for me to go to school at the community college. I blew all of his money because I could not go to school. I associated it with such failure. I would take the car and I would drive from fast food restaurant to fast food restaurant to fast food restaurant, and then find a garbage or a like a public bathroom to throw up in, and just do it over and over and over. I totally understand addiction. I totally understand compulsion. And I'm actually very grateful for that, because that changed my heart later on. But meanwhile, so I'm writing this missionary, and I'm so worried, you know, because I know now that I'm a complete screw up, and he's this righteous missionary, and he's going to come home and expect this, you know, perfect temple-worthy wife. And I was just a failure who could barely keep myself alive. That weighed on me really heavily. And so all of this darkness, these really dark periods are going on. And meanwhile, I had this friend that calls me one day, and she says, hey, you know, we're going to a club. The club was called The Bay at the time, I think. It's like a Mormon, I don't know if your listeners know this, but like in Utah, we have like nightclub where we used to, we have nightclubs with their LDS themed, like with LDS standards.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And so she had met these guys from Idaho that were really cute. And she needed another girl to her entourage. So, you know, I'm still trying to keep up appearances to a lot of people, even though I was barely hanging on. So I decided, you know, I'm going to go hang out with these guys one night. And there were these silly guys and cool. They weren't into anything like dark or heavy or poetic. It was just snowboarding and cool cars and
potatoes and chuck bales of hay.
No, actually, I mean, they weren't. They were all good looking. They all thought that they were so cool. And I remember going like, oh, please, you know, you guys are idiots. But it was so nice because I had so much dark, heavy things in my life. And here were these just like kids that cared about their cars. And here I'm writing this missionary and we're talking about like deep philosophical stuff. And, you know, I think I told you this, the missionary got diabetes on his mission. So he wrote me a letter in blood one time. I mean, our relationship was so intense, like darkly intense. It was not a healthy thing. So to have these silly boys like just want to take me snowboarding, that was so fun, and it was refreshing and different. And they weren't, you know, these return missionaries, they didn't at least act like they were trying to get married. They just wanted to make out, you know, they just wanted to make out with a girl and move on. And I was like, yeah, this is what I need. There was a particular boy in the group who had my same birthday, and he was the shyest kid. And I was like, you know, thinking, okay, are you just telling me these things that I want to hear, so I'll go out with you? And so I told this person, his name is Dallin, I told him, I'll go out with you and I'll hang out with you, but I'm getting married. At this point, I think the missionary and I were like making plans for our future. And so this Dallin kid was like, hey, that's fine. You know, we don't want to get attached. We're too cool for that. So we started hanging out and I loved it. And he was so light. Like the only thing I can explain is everything else was heavy and he was light and it was wonderful. So we hung out a lot, and the missionary had like 4 months to go on his mission. And he would call me. He wasn't supposed to, but he would break the mission rules and call me. And I told him one time, you know what? I'm starting to make out with this guy a lot and I'm hanging out with him. What should I do? I really like being with him. I don't know what to do. And he said, Lindsay, you need to end it. You need to end it right now. I'm coming home in 4 months. Just end it. This is not good.
And he was calling you from Australia.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He called me quite a bit. That's not cheap.
No, I mean, we were so connected. This sounds insane. Okay. I know how insane this sounds, but it got to the point where when he would call, I would know before he was going to call. Like I had this feeling that he was going to call me, and I took it as like, it must be the spirit. What else could it be? I mean, he's breaking mission rules, so that didn't make sense.
Well, it could be caller ID.
No, like, you know, when he had a bad day or a bad week, I knew about it. Like I just felt it, you know, like, and I think it was because anytime you invest so much emotional stock in someone and you invest all that, this time and energy, like it's almost impossible not to have some kind of manifestation that you're looking for, you know. But I took it as a spirit at the time, saying that we're supposed to be together, even though it was completely contradictory. So he told me to break up with Dallin, and I was like, yeah, you're right. This isn't right. So Dallin and I went on a drive, and I was like, you know what? We need to break up. We can't do this anymore. And I'd been telling him this all along, but kind of half-heartedly. But this time I was like, no. He's coming home and I need to do this. And, you know, Dallin left and he like screeched his car and slammed on the gas and drove off.
Like something out of an 80s movie.
Totally. And I was, you know, and I was just like, oh, what have I done? He's so fun. But we didn't connect intellectually at all. But it was nice for me, you know, to not have to think about that. I was in such pain about it. I was surprised at how hard that was for me, because I really didn't think that I was that invested in the relationship, but I was. And so I think I called him the next day, like, well, can we talk? So I was torn with that. I felt really guilty about betraying the missionary like that. But in the meantime, I'm being like totally honest with both of them. Okay. That's one bad thing about me is like, well, I don't know if it's bad, but complete honesty. So I'm telling them everything about each other, right? To ease my own conscience, you know? So the missionary came home and I kept dating Dallin, and I decided I was going to like date them both and weigh it out and see, you know, what was going to happen. And there was such pressure to get married. Okay. They both knew it about each other and they knew that I was going to do this. And to be fair, the missionary, I don't know that he was like ready to get married. It was not like he got off his mission and wanted to get married. He was having his own complete issues and journey, but we had put so much stock into like our life after, you know, he got home. And, meanwhile, this Dallin kid, we'd been dating for 3 months in Mormon time. That's a big deal. Okay. So, So he was like, what are we going to do with this relationship? So I had that pressure, and I felt so trapped at home that, and I tried to move out with my friends. I even threatened to run away with, you know, to my mom once, but she was not having it. She was like, no, you're not doing that. And if you do, I'll take the car, I'll take your money. So I really felt like marriage was the only way out. I know that sounds silly, but I...
Well, in a sense, though, I don't think it's that silly, because in a sense, what marriage would do was it would almost legitimize you as an adult, and there could be no other interaction except for you and your husband if you were to get married, right? You could be your own life again.
Yeah, and there was one thing that I actually could do and succeed at. I could get married, and then I was doing something right, because I felt like I was completely messing everything else up. And most people didn't see that. I mean, in my ward, so I was back in my ward, and I was kind of like this golden child in my ward, and they had me teach Relief Society, and they were all following this missionary saga. And, you know, I'd go to church, and they'd be like, well, which one are you going to pick?
So it was a soap opera.
It was a complete soap opera, and it was ridiculous and awful, but being naive and stupid and self-involved, I let that go on, but I hated it inside, and it was so painful to me. And awful. And so I have this raging eating disorder at the same time. And my therapist was trying to tell me, Lindsay, you don't need to make a choice. Okay. Just take time, step back from it. But I knew I was not strong enough to stand up to my parents and say, I need some independence to figure this out. So the easy way out for me was marriage. Like, that was just what I wanted to do. So the poor missionary, he came home and he's dealing with his own issues. And I wanted to, like, be married then. And, like, I had waited 2 years for this. Let's get the show on the road. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I felt. And I put a lot of pressure on him. Meanwhile, we didn't hit it off like we did in our letters. You know, we had created these two people of what we wanted to be in these letters, and it wasn't that way at all. So it was really weird between us, like, physically. And here I was making out every night with Dallin, thinking that, like, this is what a girl does, right? She's cute and she's good at making out. That's what boys want.
And we got to keep the priorities straight, right?
Yeah. And so you have to be, like, spiritual enough, but just sexy enough that, you know, that they'll want you, but not slutty, because they don't want to marry a slutty girl, mm-hmm. but just enough that, you know, that they're like, yeah, she's what I want. And so this missionary was not responding in that way at all. Poor kid had been off his mission like a week.
But you were ready to go.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, I'm going to kiss him. I'm going to make out with him, because that's what boys want. Mm-hmm. And maybe then he'll think I'm pretty. And he was totally freaked out by it. Poor, you know, like, I just looked, the whole thing was a disaster. But so I'm dating one, you know, one night, and then he'd drop me off, and then the other one would come pick me up, and they both knew about it. They both knew about it.
How did they feel?
Awful. they were being patient with it. I mean, they were both like giving arguments, you know, for themselves. But the missionary, I remember he was like, I'm not going to fight for you for this. What he was saying is, I don't want to be part of these games. But what I was thinking was, I need you to, like, tell me what to do. I need someone to stop me from this, you know. Sorry to get emotional, but I wanted someone to say, Lindsay, do this, and I'll save you, and it will be okay. But no one was doing that. And in fact, everyone was encouraging me to make a decision and pick somebody. And what I needed was to take some space, and I needed some time, and nobody gave me that. And I wasn't strong enough to give myself that. So,
well, and the other thing that I'm hearing that's interesting to me too is, this is a big life decision, and it seems like people think that it's just something that, well, just choose. What's the big deal? Just choose. When it's a bit more than that, and yeah, especially with some of the things you were going through, this is just one of those things where it's like you didn't have the control, and I mean, in a sense, you did, but it. It was kind of the fake control. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. It was like things were getting more out of control. And I remember going to my therapist one time, and I was like, you know, I'm still binging every day, but now I'm like wanting to change my clothes 3 times a day. And he said, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. Picture you standing on a floor with holes in it, and there's fire underneath, and the fire is burning, and the fire will pop up with one hole, and you'll go over and cover that hole. But the fire's still there, so it'll pop up under another hole. So you run to go cover that up, and the fire's still burning. And he said, that's what you're doing. When you're changing clothes, you're trying to cover up the fire here. And when you're binging, you're trying to cover up the fire here. And he said, we need to stop the fire. That's what we need to put out. But I didn't want to stop the fire. I wasn't ready to stop the fire, because to stop the fire for me meant having the courage to stand up for myself and to take control of my life and to stop caring what everyone thought about me. I was so concerned about being that perfect future wife, that perfect LDS girl. And I didn't want to stop that, because that's what I wanted to be. At this point, I had let both of the boys know about this bulimia, and they were both, I wouldn't say fine with it, but they, you know, it was not an issue for them. I don't think that they understood the severity of it. But I decided that I was going to marry the missionary and get rid of the other of Dallin. So Dallin and I go on this drive, and we ended up driving to Malad, Idaho, and back. And he's giving me all these ridiculous, stupid arguments about why we should be married. Like, he's quoting scriptures, and it's all the return missionary garbage that you hear that you're always rolling your eyes at. And I knew it. I was like, this is dumb stuff he's saying. He's not even like thinking about it. But something happened. I don't know. I can't even remember what he said, but something from the course of our drive changed my mind. And I remember feeling like, with him, I feel light and I feel good. And that's what I want. And so I decided, we kind of like decided I was going to choose him. And that can tell you my frame of mind. Like, I was waffling back and forth so much and so easily influenced. I mean, it's just such a recipe for disaster. And it was, but I can't explain enough the pressure that I felt to get married. I mean, even if people told me I was too young, the damage was done. I had had those messages my whole life of how this was what the end goal was, and I had no control, and that was my only out. So at this point, if anyone told me to put the brakes on, it was too late. Mm-hmm. This is my only option that I saw. So I decided I was going to marry Dallin, and we secretly got engaged.
Just to let you know, this would be the craziest version of the Bachelorette that I've ever seen.
Well, and it's equally as ridiculous, right? I hear it, and living it, it was awful. But, you know, it's silly. Like, it's just a silly little Mormon girl with feathers in her head, you know. But I was suffering, and I was hurting everybody around me in my wake. It was awful. I was such a disaster, but so concerned about not being a disaster. Finally, the missionary and I had a talk. You know, I promised myself to someone else. So I was saying things like, you know, it's probably not good for us to get married right now. You need time to adjust. And he was like, yeah, oh my gosh, yes, thank you. I do need space. Thank you for giving me this space. And he was so relieved. And so we kind of like broke it off, and he was so relieved, and like we hugged each other, and we were both crying, and we were both so happy for different reasons. Yeah. But he said to me as I left, he said, just don't get engaged, Lindsay. Just please, just wait. Don't get engaged.
The worst thing he could have told you.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I won't. But I already was. It's so awful looking back. He found out through his family, not even from me. Mm. When I started the wedding plans and after I'd gotten the ring, this missionary showed up at my house, and he hadn't shaved in a while, and he just looked awful. I'll just never forget his face, but he said to me, Lindsay, why are you doing this? Why? That's all he said to me. And I gave him this, you know, gospel answer, like, well, you know, I prayed and this is what the Lord told me to do, and it's all going to work out. And I was in such pain, and there's part of me saying, stop what you're doing, like, stop this. But I couldn't. I didn't have the courage to do it. And that was the last time I saw him for a long time. And I went ahead and got married, and it was happy, and it was perfect.
Well, hold on just a second. When this missionary left, how did you feel? How were your feelings as he was walking out the door?
I can't believe I'm getting emotional. This has been like 10 years ago. It was the worst feeling of my life. I felt like I died. That sounds really dramatic, but he was such a part of me. And I knew that letting him go was essentially like killing half of me. And that divided heart that I felt, I felt like if I could cut that out, maybe I would be whole. And I wanted him to be the problem, and I wanted him to be the darkness that I felt, and it wasn't. And I loved him so much, and I was hurting him, but I was too weak. And so I chose that weakness over everything. And that was the worst part, because I my whole life I felt like I was so selfish and vain and self-involved. And here I was choosing my weakness over, you know, him again. And I'm not saying that, you know, him and I were not healthy for each other at all, but I didn't have the courage to even like give him any respect. So, and I should say his family was really close to me. You know, his sister was my roommate, and but he struggled. And so I got married and it was perfect. And our, you know, it was ironic because when we got sealed in the Salt Lake Temple, the sealer started quoting all these scriptures that Dallin had told me in our drive up to talk about our relationship. Mm-hmm. And I took that as a sign like, oh, this is God confirming my marriage. And the sealer told us that we had chosen each other in the preexistence and all of this stuff. So it was totally an affirmation of my decisions. But I was totally still in love with someone else. I had never given myself time to grieve that relationship or even like end it properly. So I'd gotten married and I'm in this new life and I'm supposed to be totally devoted to this husband who was fantastic. He was just so wonderful and loving and kind. And he gave me that space and that freedom to get the therapy. Like, he never challenged me or made me eat or question my food. I mean, just perfectly healthy. But inside, you know, I'm in love with someone else. And I felt so awful about that because nobody told me that that happens. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I was, again, deficient or something wrong with me because I was sinning. You know, I was thinking about someone else besides my husband. And when I say thinking, it wasn't like, you know, I was, you know, having these fantasies or anything. I just could not let him go. And I felt such guilt and pain. And I would try to like call the house and pretend to ask for the sister to see if he would answer the phone. And I don't know what I would have done if he answered the phone. I wouldn't have talked to him. But it was like this really unhealthy thing because I didn't give myself any time to grieve. Again, you know, here I am trying to play out this really perfect Mormon script, but inside I'm completely different.
And you'd never had communication with the missionary since you got married?
No.
Okay.
I had heard, you know, I really tried to hear anything that I could, any scrap or crumb of information. And I remember my husband made some joke at the time, like I was cooking dinner. And I said, gosh, you know, this is a new recipe and it's really difficult. And he said, oh, don't screw it up or I'll find a wife in the next life. Just some funny joke, right? That was probably really funny. But I remember I took that to heart because I was like, no, what? That's not fair. I had to give up someone I love and choose between two people I love to one. Like, how come you get to love two people in the next life? That started to eat at me a lot. So this idea of Mormon polygamy started to really eat at me. But in the meantime, you know, I'm being like this great Mormon wife. I'm a really good cook. I've got my house really cute. We bought a house and we're just living that life. And it was great. I'm not going to say that it wasn't because it was. But I was still dealing with all these issues. And I was getting therapy and making a lot of progress with the eating. But I was still internalizing a lot of this secret pain. And my poor husband, he knew about it. You know, I'd been open with him from the beginning.
Really?
Yeah. And I tell you, he's like a saint. If you want to feel bad for anyone in the story, feel bad for him. Because I would wake up, I would try not to think about the missionary during the day because I felt like it was sinful. So I tried to like block him from my mind or replace it with a hymn or a scripture, the same kind of patterns I did with my food. And then I would dream about him every night and I would wake up crying in my sleep. My husband would like rock me and hold me and say, oh, are you thinking about him again? Just so good. So much more goodness than I deserved for that. But it was just so painful. And it took me about 6 years, I think, until I could finally let that relationship go. We had some closure, I want to say, about 4 years after I'd been married. He had contacted my friend Malia, and her and I had reconciled, and I can talk about that in a minute, but he had gotten married at this point, and I'm sure he was dealing with the same things I was dealing with, like feeling guilt for not letting this thing go, mm-hmm. but being married. But there was no closure, so we kind of like sent some messages, and we were very cautious with what we said because we were both Mormon married people. But I apologized the best way that I could, and that helped. And he told me he was happy, and that made me feel really great.
To know that he was able to move on as well.
Yeah, and not to say that I'm so vain that I thought that I could ruin his life. I felt like I was toxic to everybody around me at the time. So to know that like that was only part of his life and he was able to move on from that, that made me feel better, if that makes sense.
So that chapter is in a sense you could say that chapter closed when you were able to talk with him and kind of have this closure type of period.
That finally helped healing. After I had had my babies and everything, I felt good about my decision. Meanwhile, I had reconciled with my friend Malia because I had messed up my life so much. I didn't really, you know, need to be as self-righteous as I had been. Having those compulsions with the eating really gave me a lot of compassion in the gospel. And I've talked about this with you before. It started really making me question the narratives in the church, like men and pornography or homosexuality. I mean, the rhetoric, you know, in my neighborhood and everything was gay people are choosing to be this way. And as we moved away from that and they were born this way, but it's a struggle that they have to deal with, that really troubled me. And I don't want to be offensive to any of the LGBTQ people out there, because this is just my story and how I came to where I'm at now. But I remember thinking, okay, well, if they were born this way and it's their challenge to overcome this, and something's not right about that, because here I was with this compulsion to eat and throw up, but I didn't want it. And I tried to fight it and I tried to pray it away. And the more that I tried to be righteous, the worse it got. And the more that I tried to fight it, the worse it got. And so I thought about that with, you know, gay people. If they were drawn to it as much as I was drawn to eating, then there's no way that anyone could judge them on the same way that God would judge any other sin. It was different.
You know,
does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. I actually wrote a note down here. It was interesting when you were talking about some of the struggles you had with eating disorders, and you were talking about suicide, and you said that suicide was the only way that you felt that you could get away from it because this was something that was following you and you didn't have control over it and things like that. I actually wrote down homosexuality question mark because simply because so many people that I talk to seem to I don't think my dad's going to ever listen to this. I was talking to my dad about it, and he said, I don't understand homosexuality and I don't understand the struggles. I said, well, Dad, you're straight. Of course you don't understand homosexuality because you can't comprehend what it's like to – in a sense to have feelings for another man – and not be able to control that. And oh, by the way, tell yourself, this is wrong. I'm not supposed to be feeling this way. And all my church leaders have been saying this. In a sense, it was kind of the same struggle that you were having with your eating disorder, was simply, this is wrong. I know I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I can't stop myself.
Yeah. And that's what first started to change my heart, I think, is no one wanted to be more righteous and perfect than me. I wanted it so bad, and I loved the gospel, and it was such a part of my life, and I tried so hard. And I think when gay people say that they try hard to overcome this, I think some people are suspicious, you know, in the back of their mind, well, they must not have tried this or this or this. I knew I tried everything I could possibly do. I was getting therapy. I was getting nutritionist advice. I was doing outpatient therapy. I had lost so much because of it, and I was threw myself into the gospel, and it didn't fix it. And so I knew that if God was going to judge them for that, he would have to judge them on completely different terms, because it was impossible. That kind of really opened my mind, And my friend Malia, meanwhile, would not go back to church because of the gay issues with the church. And I started to kind of talk with her about it and empathize. And I wasn't in a totally good place with it. I still thought, you know, there's something I'm missing because the church is true and all of that. But when we moved into our ward, there was a little girl that had gotten flashed by a flasher. The story grew and grew, and the flasher eventually, the story grew that he, shook his genitals at her, and then he was wearing women's clothing, and then he stood outside her window. I mean, the story grew, so their credibility was kind of sketchy anyway, but the only man that got questioned for the crime was the only gay man in our neighborhood. There was no evidence to, link him to the crime at all. None. But of course, at the time, it all made sense to us. Like, if there's a man in women's clothing, it's got to be the gay guy, right? It just made sense to us. And so he was questioned. He let the police come in and check his house for women's clothing, and they didn't find anything. And I remember at the time hearing the chatter in the neighborhood, and it just didn't sit well with me. I thought, this isn't right. This isn't right. And, you know, I had just read To Kill a Mockingbird, and I thought, oh my gosh, we're doing the same thing that they did with blacks in the South, the homosexuals. And that was huge for me to think the church was actually doing something not quite right, you know. But at this point, I also knew that the narrative that they teach you in the church didn't always work because I had tried it. So I was starting to have these questions. So I reconciled with my friend Malia, and which was fantastic for me, and because I had felt such guilt for being so awful, and I had been so humbled by my experience, and she was really gracious about it, and she apologized for the things that she had done. So I was, you know, finally getting my life on track, and I got pregnant, and that was the first time that I think I had enough tools in my emotional toolkit to realize, I don't think I want to cope this way anymore. I don't need this. I want to be healthy for my child. And it was a decision for me. It wasn't anyone making me do it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that was huge. So I was able to totally correct a lot of those dangerous behaviors. Things were finally settling down in that way. But as those were settling down, my life was finally, I was pulling myself together and becoming successful. And, you know, I started a business at home. I just teach preschool at home, and I work for an online company, and I was, you know, I just felt like I had it together now. Mm-hmm. That's when I started getting big callings in the church, which led me to start finding things out that I didn't want to find out. And I told you about that joke that my husband had made at the mm-hmm. beginning. That always really ate at me, because I felt like it wasn't fair. I was really caught up on that fairness issue of how come he gets to be with a lot of women, but I had to give up one of the biggest loves of my life. It's just not fair.
Wait a minute. You were actually thinking that polygamy wasn't fair because you might not have two husbands?
Yeah, I know, right?
I've never heard it that way from... Anyway, I'll continue.
No, I mean, I've always been in, justice and truth have always been so important to me. So that really didn't sit well with me. And there was a DVD that came out in the mail from, I think, I don't want to condemn a whole religious denomination, but I think it was the Baptists that were going to come convert the Mormons in Utah, if I remember right, a few years ago. And it was a big deal in the news. And they
prepared- That was the infamous cross on the DVD cover, and then the LDS picture of Joseph Smith on it, right?
Yes, yep. Someone, and they mailed it out. I can't remember exactly, but I think they mailed it out to random people. And of course I wasn't going to touch that because, you know, I think Hinckley had linked anti-Mormon stuff to poison.
Yeah.
But it was in the news, it was everywhere, and I remember the church news or something said, well, if you want to counter what's on the DVD, you can go to Fair LDS. The org. And I was like, well, if the church says that's okay, Fair LDS must be a church thing. So I got on the apologist site, and I've heard this a lot, but I think apologists do more damage to testimonies than they do good. Not knowing much about anything, Fair totally validated all of these horrible things. Like, they acknowledged Joseph Smith was a polygamist. I had no idea. I was 25. And no idea. I knew Brigham was, never knew Joseph was. And if I did it, I just never thought about it. And I didn't know that he married women. I didn't know that he did it behind Emma's back. Like, I was just like, what the heck? And here are LDS scholars from BYU saying, yeah, that happened, but let me explain it this way. And what that did for me, one of the biggest apologist arguments was, well, prophet or men are their time, and, you know, that's how they understood the doctrine. And I thought, hold on. So if prophet are men of their time and they can get it wrong or make mistakes or interpret it different, that means our prophet can do the same thing. Holy cow. That was such a fantastic realization for me to realize that. And that just kind of opened up everything.
That's a curious way to describe it, a fantastic realization. Why would you describe it that way?
Because the church being so good for me was harmful in that it alienated me from all this, the beauty that was out there in the world, the beautiful people that I had rejected, the friends that I had rejected, because my best friend that I had condemned for righteousness, gay people that I was rejecting because I thought that they were being sinful. This idea that we are so much more than just the simple little script in life. I had lived it. I knew that life was more complicated than black and white. Mm-hmm. I'd lived all those grays. It made everything so beautiful and painful. I was devastated to find out this stuff, and more devastated that I couldn't talk about it with anyone, because I was used to talking about my pain and no one would talk about it with me because they didn't know about it. And I'm like, wait a minute, the church is saying this and this and this. And everybody, you know, here was Lindsay doing something crazy again, you know, crazy Lindsay getting into something weird. She just put this eating disorder behind her, and now she's got this thing. But at this point, I knew that people, the church had gotten homosexuality wrong. I knew it because I had lived it. I hadn't lived it, but I'd lived a contradiction, and I knew that they were wrong. And I knew my best friend didn't deserve to be alienated for her religion. And I'm not saying that the church would have told me to handle it that way at all, but I also knew that my friend who had died of cancer, that he deserves to be angry. That he got a bum deal. I mean, he didn't have to be happy about it. I just, all these things that I had tried to make sense of with the gospel and couldn't make sense, now they made sense because I didn't need to make sense of them anymore with the gospel, because prophets got it wrong sometimes. That was just so fantastic to realize. And so that kind of started my whole feminist awakening. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. Let's get into that.
So I'm starting to deal with these issues with the church. Can't talk about them with anyone. And online, I discover Feminist Warm and Housewives. And, you know, a few years ago, they were still pretty careful about what they were saying.
If you had to put a time frame on this, when would you say this is?
I want to say like 2007.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so they're still being really careful about what they're saying, but they were talking about some dicey stuff, and in a way that I never heard it talked about. I mean, they would be critical. If there was something to be critical with the church about, they would be critical. And that was so refreshing to me, because that was not acceptable anywhere in any of the circles that I ran in. You didn't question that when the prophet spoke, you know, that the discussion was over. So that was great. And then we had the famous Elder Packer talk of what, 2010? Was that when it was? About homosexuality.
Yep.
I was in Young Women's at the time, dealing with young women who were just so broken from life at that age, trying to do good, but they were just so focused on, well, we'll get into that in a minute, but the homosexuality thing just totally broke my heart. And I was so angry, and I was angry at Elder Packer. And I remember going in, I had a new baby at the time. I went into a chapel for a farewell or homecoming or something. And I was out in the hall with a baby, and the rest of the church was quiet because they were all in the chapel. And I walked into the high council room. I was just, you know, rocking the baby. And there was the Quorum of the Twelve hanging on the wall. And I saw Packer's picture, and he was like staring at me, his picture. And I was staring at him, and it was like the showdown. You can hear like Western music in the background. And I'm just having this conversation with him in my head of like, just these just this narrative of my life saying, Packer, you're saying these things, but you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And where's the compassion? And I was, you know, just really chastising him in my head. And I had this urge to take his picture off the wall and like steal it. I was going to steal it. And it doesn't make sense, but I was like, well, no, Lindsay, you can't do that. Stealing's wrong. You know, what are you going to do with it? So I was like, well, I could take it and just hide it. I'll hide it. And I knew that just seems silly. You know, like I'm a grown woman. I can't act this way now. So I took the picture and I just turned it backwards. And that felt so naughty and heretical. I can't say that word. I felt like a heretic. Mm-hmm. But it also felt like so necessary. And that was the first time I'd openly like allowed myself to say, this is wrong. And it, you know, like power to the people. It didn't matter because here I was in this room and it didn't matter. But to me, it mattered. It was like me finally standing up for what was right. Mm-hmm. Even though it wasn't something I was supposed to do. And so that kind of blew it open. And then I started writing for Feminist Warren Housewives and working out that pain. And that opened up all the feminist issues. I'd never really had feminist issues. I've told you this. I was really good at church. I was really good at appearing to be the good Mormon wife. That worked for me. Mm-hmm. I liked to cook. I liked being a mother for the most part. And I was good at it, at least outwardly. Women were jealous of me. And that's how I gained my power. So, you know, when women were saying that they were feeling left out, I understood it with polygamy. Mm-hmm. But I was like, well, that's just because you're not a good cook, you know. And then I realized, my husband mentioned it to me. He said, Lindsay, you're part of the problem. Because you have to be so good at something, that means someone else isn't. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm hurting people. You know, me excelling at these things and... You know, that's how I found my power in the church. And that kind of was my feminist awakening, because for me to have power, the only power that I had was for me to step on other women. Mm-hmm. And that was like, whoa, something's wrong here. If that's how it has to work. No wonder I can't connect with women in relief society. No wonder. And so that's kind of, I guess it's kind of how it started. Well, I know most like feminists that I know, like they recognize the inequality when they saw it. Mm-hmm. They went to the temple and their hearts were broken. I went to the temple and I was like, this is awesome. I love symbolism. You know, I was so part of the system. I didn't realize it. For women like me, we can gain power in the church. Being good at those things. If you're a good cook, if you're a good mother, or at least if you know how to appear to be, then it works for you. And then, like, Sister Julie Beck, she's gained power in the church from being good at those things. And it works for her. She knows the right things to say and follow that narrative. The problem is, many, many women don't fit that narrative. And even when I had my first son, I don't remember the first 6 months of it. And I think I've said this before. Teresa Edmonds has said this. Being a mom was so hard for me those first 6 months. Nurturing, like when they say that women are inherently nurturers, that's kind of offensive because I was not inherently a good nurturer. It was hard for me. I had to earn that. And so I don't think it's fair to say or to put that pressure on women to say, oh, you're just born this way, because I had to work for that. These roles that we were like promised, I already knew that certain narratives didn't work. And so it made me realize, you know, this narrative doesn't work. It works for me because I enjoy these things, but there's so many women that are in pain because of it, and so many that it doesn't work for. And so I knew that it wasn't right, and it kind of opened the doors to all of the misogyny that was out there. And I should say that that's not exclusive to just us. It's society.
Yeah, and I understand that. You know, it's interesting. My wife and I were having a conversation last night. We're in the process of trying to have kids, and we're having those conversations about, is can we make this work with just the two of us, with my income alone, or is she going to have to work? And we were talking just about the economics of the situation, and she'll probably have to work. And I forget what she was talking about, but she said, you know, there's a lot of women out there who that's all they want to do is work, and that's fine with them. She was an English major, so she got in – granted, she was an English major at BYU, so they treat it lightly, but they did get into some feminist issues. And she said, you want to know the kind of feminism that I wish I had? I wish I had the kind of feminism where I can choose my own thing and I don't have to worry about someone telling me, oh, you're a woman and you're a strong woman, you should work, or you're a weak woman and you should stay at home. I want to be able to do what I want to do. I want to be an intelligent woman who had some success in her career but decided to stay at home.
She's a feminist. That's what we are. Hooray.
And you and I had talked about this in the past, about these different waves of feminism.
Yeah, feminism is a scary word for a lot of people, and it has, you know, a really bad reputation, and there are a lot of reasons why. But I will say, in any movement, in any kind of activism or movement, we need loud, radical voices to break the silence. Do you know what I'm saying? And this goes for any movement, feminism, civil rights, it doesn't matter. So you're going to have the people that are loud and make people uncomfortable. And there is a purpose for that, and that's necessary. But that doesn't represent the entire movement, because then you have people that come in that can work from the ground up and the grassroots efforts and make change and change hearts and change minds. And with feminism, the first wave was women being able to recognize the inequality, the fact that they couldn't vote, they couldn't own property, that they couldn't divorce, that they couldn't take care of their children. That was huge. So first wave was getting basic human rights for women. And the second wave was kind of that radical change, opening your eyes to all the misogyny out there. And misogyny, here's the thing, is not men hating women. It's everyone hating women. Like, the worst oppressors of women are women. We hate each other more than men will ever hate us. Men need us too much. You know what I mean? Women oppress women in awful, awful ways. So we needed those second waivers to go in there and be radical and to shake things up and to say, you know what? If I don't want to wear makeup, if I don't want to get married, I don't have to. Because they were breaking through the whole cult of domesticity where, you know, we kind of fetishize the role of a woman. That wasn't fair, you know, but it needed to happen. And now they've kind of paved the way for what I consider myself, which is like a third wave feminist, which is what your wife was saying, which is women should be able to choose whatever they want to do as long as they choose to do that. You know, if a woman wants to stay home and take care of her kids, that is awesome and she should be able to do it. But she shouldn't have to do it because those are her only options. Because that makes really terrible mothers. If every woman is forced to be a mother and she's not good at it, or she doesn't want to do it, or she doesn't have the skill set in place or the education or the emotional health to be a good mother, she should probably not be a mother. Feminism is not women against men. It's giving men and women equal opportunities. It's not saying men and women have to look the same or dress the same or act the same. It's saying just give everyone the choice. I really am probably too optimistic, but I believe that feminism can change a lot of the world's problems. If you're suspicious about it, look up, it's called The Girl Effect on YouTube. And it just talks about if you give a girl an opportunity, she'll be able to pull herself out of poverty and be able to kind of fix the problems for herself. And I saw that in my own life. If I were given more proper tools and more options and more time and space, I had the power within me to fix my own problems. And I did eventually. That's what I think it's about. And I think that so many women especially say, you know, the church values women and we're equal. And what I say to them is just a simple test. Go to your sacrament meeting and sit through it and regender the whole service while you're sitting there. Take every man that's participating in whatever capacity and pretend he's a woman and that the women are men. And you'll see how completely lopsided our church is. Completely lopsided. And once you start seeing that, you see that it's everywhere, that women who are supposed to be so divine and so special really have no divine pattern to follow. They really don't have a lot of options in the church like men do, and they have way more pressure on them for certain things that they can't control than men do. And so that's where I feel like men feel like they're being, you know, criticized or threatened when I say, you know, men versus women in that way. But it's not about that. Women Women in our church are the biggest defenders of the patriarchy, probably more so than men.
Do you think that that's going to change? Do you think that you're seeing more feminist type individuals gain some stronger voices within the church, or do you think it's going backwards?
You know, I've heard good cases made for both ways. But I tend to think, you know, our generation, meaning my generation of younger girls, we were raised by mothers that were probably most of us anti-feminists, because they, you know, raised us and saw the radical feminists of the 70s. But something about those women, about our mothers, raised us to know that we are of worth and we are of value somewhere. And that's why so many of us are starting to recognize these patterns, and not just in society, but if we allowed in society what we allow at church, for men to run every single auxiliary and to have the ultimate authority and to say all the prayers at General Conference and to have all of our texts be about men, our scripture texts and all of our hymns be about men, and the only time it's about women are when they're whores or obedient wives. Like, if we allowed that kind of thing to go on in society now, I don't know of anyone my age that would stand for that at all. I mean, it still exists in society, like men completely dominate the government and that kind of thing. But I know that even these women that consider themselves anti-feminist would not stand for that. But yet we stand for it in the church, and we do it happily, and we think it's our divine purpose. And that's the thing. None of us are interested in taking away the divine purpose of anyone. We just don't think that God is so simple that he would make divine purpose so small. Women are so much more than one thing. You know, women have so much power and we have so much to offer as it is, but the things that we discuss in religious society now are so small, you know, and my worldview has opened up a lot to the pain of women and the problems all over, you know, like I'm an activist for women's issues all over the world. In Relief Society, we focus on, you know, policing our husbands from pornography. And if you go through our lesson manual and then you compare it to the problems that women are facing all over the world, it's so small. And I think it's so unnecessary, because it doesn't need to be. I mean, sure, we can work on small things in our own lives. As women, we're taught to focus on things like modesty, which is totally an outward reflection of an inward thing. And it just, women are taught to be suspicious of each other at church, to not open up and be genuine, because it's so competitive, because women only get power through these certain divine roles of being a mother. It becomes competitive, because how can you compare, how do you know who's a good mother and who's not? You don't know ever, but what you can judge it by is by their, you know, how clean and cute their kids look, or how well behaved they are, or how good of a casserole they make, and how clean their house is. So women are killing themselves for these things that really don't have anything to do with who they are or you know, their purpose. And I think that that's why we have a lot of artificial relationships in the church. If we could express our private pain a little bit more, like visiting teaching would be a great opportunity for that. Women are just too afraid to do that now, because we want to appear to be doing what's right, because our righteousness is equated with these outward things. There's so many small little flaws that could be so easily corrected. And that's kind of what we're working towards. And now I know a lot of the listeners at Mormon Expression, I don't want to offend them by talking about God or talking about changing the church, because I totally understand and sympathize with the idea of, you know what, it's a lost cause, we need to leave it alone. But I also, I've told John Larson this many times, I'm Mormon. I didn't choose to be Mormon. I was born into it. And I'm always going to be Mormon. All the stories in my head are Mormon. When I think of like a metaphor for life, I think of a pioneer metaphor. You know, I don't know any other stories. This is my life. This is my experience. And so these are my people, and I'm not ready to leave them behind yet. There's too much pain there. And if you think that changing the church is pointless and you can move on, then move on. Heal yourself and get away from the pain. But try to also be respectful of those who can't, whose identities are so inseparable from this thing. And that's kind of what I'm interested in doing right now, is just helping women with their pain work through it, because pain's okay, and it's healthy, and it's a part of life. And I don't know if you've ever heard that poem by Carolyn Pearson, Pioneers. Have you heard that poem?
I haven't, no.
It's fantastic. She relates us to being pioneers. She starts the poem off and says, "My people are Mormon pioneers. Is the blood still good?" And I think about that all the time. Is the blood still good? You know, we have this really fake narrative of pioneers now in the church that we draw strength from, that's kind of really historically inaccurate. But pioneers followed truth, and they sacrifice for truth. And I feel like that's what so many Mormon Expression listeners do. They've sacrificed their families and sometimes their whole lives for truth, even if they didn't want to. And it's been painful for them. And so we're all pioneers in a way, even if the truth that we're following is different than the truth that our ancestors were following. You know, Carolyn Pearson says in that poem, you have to pack your handcart and only take the precious things and leave out all the rest. And you follow truth to the West. And that's what I'm doing. And that's the journey that I'm on. I'm trying to take the precious things with me. And right now my handcart is really meager compared to the wagons of my neighbors at church with the things that they think are precious, but that's okay. I think that all of us as Mormons were sought to seek truth, and sometimes truth is hard and takes us in a different direction, and that's okay.
Actually, I think that is a good way to end it, don't you?
Sure. Yeah.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, just that my heart really is full of love for everybody.
Even believers like me?
Even believers like you. Yeah, aww. I just, that's the one thing that I disagree with. I hate all this fighting in the Mormon community of everyone has a faith thermometer out, and it either has to be too hot or too cold. I just want us all to get along. I just want to give everybody a hug. And if you need a hug, I will give you a hug.
I think the bigger question is where they're sticking the thermometer.
I don't want to know that. I'll give you a hug. Just don't pull out your thermometer.
There we see. We didn't get into a lot of sex talk this one, so at least we got that little one.
Well, I behaved this time.
I know. Well, Lindsay, I want to thank you for coming on the program today. I think this was a great interview, and I really appreciate you opening up and being really honest with us. Lindsay does an awesome series over at Feminist Mormon Housewives called The Forgotten Wives of Joseph Smith. I highly recommend you check it out. It's awesome research, and there's some awesome stories there. She blogs under the name Winter Buzz. And Lindsay, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You think I should be? No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet of who I will become. Oh, but I'm feeling brave. I got nothing to lose. I'm so beautiful as I make no excuse. Now better me.